So, any questions? Comments? Fears, joys, sorrows, ambitions, expectations, depressions. I know I gave you a lot of information, and maybe just superficial skimming of the surface, but I did want to reveal the terrain a little bit so that you understood what, a little bit, of what wisdom is all about. What is the wisdom that the Buddha is talking about, you know, in these five faculties?
So, I just wanted to follow up on the control issue. You know, some of us have the type A personalities and kind of want to...
Control.
Control. And so, not doing anything is challenging, but there is aspiration. There is, we are doing some seed planting and stuff. So we are seeking to be diligent and heedful and all that stuff. And so how do we avoid trying to control but encourage ourselves to be diligent and heedful?
Well, I think we make effort and we have intention, and we may have an aspiration which is some understanding or some vision of the direction we're going. But if we try to control to create and make something happen, you can be sure it's a little tight and it might quite likely not happen that way, and you'll end up with frustration. So yes, we want to have a direction. Yes, we want to have an intention. Yes, we want to make effort. But no, we don't want to demand that all of that produce a certain effect, because that beyond the reach of those qualities of mind. There are other things that come into play to make anything happen, other causes and conditions. Your intention, your aspiration, and your energy are some, but not all. But those are what we have some guidance over, some direction over, and those are all fueled by our understanding, our wisdom. And if you have more wisdom, then those can be stronger and have a greater influence on the direction of the unfolding of the mind. Still can't control it, but a greater influence. And if your wisdom is very weak, then your aspiration is very flimsy or very unformed. Your intention may be just kind of sporadic and not very strong, and the energy may be erratic and not very effective. So the result is a long ways from your control, so to speak. But with more wisdom, as these get stronger, then there's more influence on the resulting experience, or the result of all of those aspiration, intention, and effort. So I think control is kind of a strong wrong. Whereas influencing and guiding and sculpting and moving and you know, that's more how it really is. We have some influence, some guiding, and some, you know, effect at part of conditioning, part of the conditioning. But control is beyond the reach of intention. Yeah.
You made few minutes ago about how the key to this being awareness and always coming back to what's arising, what's coming along, and the quality of the knowing, which my mind is reading into that depth of the awareness. I do feel myself to, when I feel what I believe is awareness, if there are levels of it in my experience. So,
just in speaking about the quality of awareness, I think, you know, I mentioned before, sometimes it's like seeing into the bottom of a clear pool and seeing what's on the bottom, and sometimes it's like feeling down through a muddy bunch of muck and guck and feeling what's there and kind of getting a sense of what something is. So there is there's a spectrum of qualities of awareness, and sometimes it's very clear, sometimes it's murky, sometimes it's quick, sometimes it's slow, sometimes it's, you know, and just by paying attention, we will begin to catalog the varieties of experience of awareness. You know, of course, there are many objects which is awareness is taking. So sometimes the object conditions the awareness, sometimes our energy and our understanding, our aspiration, all of these also condition our awareness. So we want to be respectful of making, you know, our effort. We make our effort, but we should be careful not to demand a certain type of experience. You know, because you know, that's beyond the capacity of simply making effort. But nevertheless, we still get caught sometimes in, you know, I'm doing this and I want some kind of experience. Well, that kind of attachment or identification is going to cause some suffering there. Did that answer your question? I don't remember what the question was. Okay. Are there comments or questions? Yeah.
Your explanation, or I guess you call it an explanation, of why the healing might happen, that as the mind is balanced, I guess I'm repeating so that I understand what
sure.
I heard. As the mind becomes more balanced, this and the ill tissue
yes.
goes away. What is being created? Each moment by your body is healthy.
Condition that which is conditioned by the mind is more of a healthy yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I was feeling real skeptical about those stories earlier, but when you said that, I thought, okay, thanks.
Don't talk to a doctor about that. They might not think it makes so much sense. But it, you know, when you take a look at all of the Buddha's teachings on the mind and the body and the source of the body and the source of material elements and stuff, that's how you can put it together. Does that jive with Western medical anatomical stuff? No, because in Buddhist understanding of body, they don't even have anatomical things like we have. So there's kind of like two different maps. You know, one is a map of all the, you know, all the terrain, and the other one's a map of all the restaurants along the way. And it's like somehow, yeah, they're talking about the same thing, but they don't apparently overlap so easily, like that.
But it was really helpful to sort of
get
something
like that.
Oh yeah,
possibility. Yeah.
Well, I think it struck me reading, you know, Lodge of Masters, both Ramadan and other. Is that they seem to keep cooking till fairly late in life, even in terms of their cultures. They seem to stay, they just keep teaching and never stop. The wisdom thing just goes right up to the end, almost always. And they don't seem to get senile. And that's really interesting. I mean, there's some pattern there. Right?
You mean hopeful?
But it's also, there's a real pattern, you can't ignore that. You know,
no, yeah.
Yeah. That strikes me, and I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
I observe the same thing, that there are some pretty, you know, I went to see Upandita. I was in Burma again in December. I went to see Upandita, who was my monastic teacher and been my teacher for many years. And he's, what, 87 or something now, had quadruple bypass, you know, a couple years ago. And I was really amazed. He's, you know, he's 87, he's overweight, he's big guy. And, you know, he came out, I was at the monastery to visiting, and then he came out of his cottage. He came out of his cottage and he put on his slippers. He was over there. And he came walking over, and when he saw me, oh, he was kind of, oh, yeah, come here, come here, come see me. So I went to see him, And he walked to his cottage. He says, "Oh, come in. I want to talk to you." So he came in, and here he is. He's 87. He's overweight. He's got heart condition. When he gets to his door of his cootie, he has on slippers, sandals like tongs. You know where they got the thing between the toe. So he kicks off his. He kind of shuffles off his two things, and then he takes and picks both of them up in one foot. And puts them up on a shelf like that. I mean, I can't do that. And it's just, you know, he just doesn't bend down and pick them up with his hand. He just picks them up and puts them up there like. So I just said, that's amazing. It's just, you know, I don't know, I guess I'm easily impressed. I just thought, right on. You know, his mind is so sharp and so strong. It's just like you don't want to get in an argument with this guy. There's no wavering at all. And so you're right. When you see that, you think, "Jeez," and he's been practicing a long time. Yeah. Yeah.
My question is how do we move from attachment to difficult emotions to non-attachment? I watch myself. During this process of meditating is feeling shame. And
shame.
My body. And, there's always seems to be a certain effect that I'm very attached to those emotions in a way they're very painful. Because I seem to be identified with them. How do you, so you feel them.
Yes.
And what's the process you take to get to non-identification?
Yeah, well, now when you say you're attached to them, you see that, they stick around. You can't let go of them somehow. Okay. Well, to take that example, you have an emotion, you feel anything, and it often comes with a story, right? There's a story of why I feel so angry or why I feel so ashamed, right? And that story is often a memory. And so as you feel, did you say shame?
Yeah. There wasn't a story. It wasn't.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to go in. I don't want to go into that either. But as you feel it, you first get this feeling of like, whatever. And then you're paying attention to that. You're paying attention to the physical sensations of this emotion, and you know that this is the mental state of shame or anger or fear, whatever. And your mindfulness is just, this is being known. What's being known? Sensations being known. Emotion being known, thoughts being known, memory being known, something being known. So you're deconstructing this whole package, this whole emotional explosion into just something being known, something else being known. And that process of just staying with it, it may last, and sometimes they last for a while. And then you fall out of your mind first, you get re-entangled in the story, and you start it back up again, and something being. Eventually, you deconstruct this package of the emotion into its pixels. These kinds of sensations, these kinds of thoughts, these kinds of memories, these kinds of images, these kinds of plans for revenge, these kinds of, and you see all that stuff, and it's just a bunch of, well, in time, you see, these things just arise due to condition, not because of you, and you can't stop them. They just arise. But when you identify with them, when you appropriate them as my feeling, my memory, my sensations, my judgments, then you suffer. When you just see them as the impersonally unwindingness that it really is, then you stop suffering. But it takes some experience. It takes some practice doing that, just to just see things unwind as pixels rather than the story of me, even. But it does. It happens. It comes. And once you see this again and again in pixelated form, the glue of identification doesn't kind of re-solidify it. Yeah, the memory's still there. The feeling may come. The impulse to be reactive in whatever way you were may be there, but you don't go there. because, you know, the mindfulness is just seeing it, and the delusion that's required for identification can't get in there. Because you're just seeing. The arising of all these physical, mental, emotional, memory-type cognitive things. And it deconstructing it doesn't go back together into the story of me. Oh, I'm so... Now, what happens when you deconstruct an emotional event like that is the sense of self that was conditioned into being by the conjunction of those conditions. Do you get that? The sense of self that appeared due to the conjunction of these conditions. Somebody said something or did something to you, creating a certain feeling this way that you interpreted that way. That sense of yourself that got conditioned right then, when you see all the pixels that go into that, the sense of self dissolves. Then there's just pixels. There's just the events. There's just the memory of they said this, this was the feeling, this was the intention, this was the emotional reaction, this was the story. No self. It's just... That's kind of the analytical view of how it happens. But it really happens with a lot of self-love and acceptance. That's the fuel for being willing to see this way. A lot of self-acceptance. And really understanding that to see this activity of yourself, and as painful as it is, as much suffering as it is, painful as it is really a very compassionate thing to do. It's the most compassionate thing you can do, is to feel your pain.
Well, I felt like a lot of heaviness. I felt like my body's never felt so heavy.
Great.
I felt pulled down.
Yeah, feel heaviness.
It's interesting, I was watching it from that level, that I could actually not get so attached in some ways. It's like, wow, this is so curious, and I feel so pulled down, you know?
Yeah. Never felt gravity quite like that.
Never felt gravity like that.
Yeah. Yeah, just feel it. Just feel, oh, this is heaviness. Because it is. It's all impersonal. I mean... Heaviness is as impersonal as you can get. It's just heaviness. Oh, I feel it. Of course, it feels like I'm heavy. But if you say, oh, I'm heavy, I'm really... Then that's being identified. But if you just see it as generic, kind of impersonal heaviness, the nature of heaviness, then no self. No problem.
When you're describing deconstructing memories, I'm wondering, do you make any distinction between the sort of normal, traditional, neurotic memories and traumatic memories where somebody's brutalized, or, you know, the memories that are well beyond everyday, very dysfunctional family life?
In the course of unwinding the mind?
Is there any distinction made, or?
It happens across the spectrum. You know, ordinary memories of what somebody said at lunch, to recovery of abuse memories that have been suppressed, repressed, and all the emotion that comes with it can be very shocking and terrifying, and need a lot of understanding of what's going on there. Any teacher who really understands what's going on in the mind, and can do it. You know, I've seen and helped guide a lot of people actually through very long and painful abuse memory recovery, to where, you know, things that were unknown to them, you know, well into their adult years, 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, then they recover their memories of things that happened to them and have to deal with the emotional feeling that occurred at that time in an adult, now in their adult life. Really hard. But it's like recovering your life. It's like recovering your life. And if you're motivated to recover your life, then it's just what's got to be done, and you'll do it. It happens. Other comments or questions, or should we plan on wrapping it up. Yeah.
I also want to thank you for talking about that, because I feel like some of the teachers have emphasized the abstract when they talk about meditation and no self. But for me, I feel like I have to give self. I can't possibly contemplate no self. Are you kidding? I'll be really happy to get to self.
Yeah.
So I kind of wonder why there's not more emphasis when teachers are, you know, on retreats and everything, about the personal history and how you have to get there. Instead, it's a little bit abstract.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the talks are, you know, emphasize Buddhism and no self, which I personally kind of tune out when somebody says no self, because
yeah.
I don't understand what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate that the way you map this out, it makes a lot of sense to me. But I really wonder why more teachers don't talk a little bit about it. So, thank you.
I'm not sure why teachers don't. I can't speak for anybody else. I think most teachers know the process of self-recovery to the point of then you can then see no self. I think most teachers who've been through any depth of their own practice and levels, layers of insight or progressive insight see that. I only understand it from kind of a patchwork, you know, talking with and getting advised by psychiatrists, psychologists, and seeing it through, you know, dozens, hundreds of students, the process, and then, you know, a dozen or 15 very dramatic self-recovery trauma episodes, if you will, that sometimes take years, decades to get through. But nevertheless, what else are you doing with your life? And so I just speak about it from personal experience. I don't really know how psychiatrists would talk about it or what the whole self structure is that's happening or not happening or how it happens. I don't know that. But from my layman's but Dharma-informed perspective and my own process, this is how I understand it. You can ask the psychiatrists in the room how, you know, whether it sounds right or not, or therapists or counselors, and there's all kinds of them around.
Can you give me an example of a question that comes from the relative reality, and when you said you skillfully sort of have to understand the context from which that question comes?
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah. Sure. So the question, I'm talking about relative and absolute reality. You know, somebody says, hey, what do you mean no self? You know, you're you, I'm me, this is self. What's this no self thing? Well, you know, in this plane of existence, there's self. There's me and there's you. You know, I'm not me. I'm not me. Yeah, right. I'm not you. I'm not you. I'm not me either. And you know, we want to be clear. You know, my feelings are my feelings. Your feelings are your feelings. Your thoughts are your thoughts. My feelings are my thoughts. But when you get inside and you start looking at what's going on in here, you know, a skillful teacher will guide you to see that, you know, your thoughts, not your thoughts. Your feelings, not your feelings. You know, where do they come from? Oh, they come from causes and conditions that are very impersonal to you. But in this level of this reality, you need to own your own feelings. I need to own my own feelings. I have to be responsible for my thoughts. And I have to, you know, whether I express them or act on them, I'm responsible for that. And I will reap the karmic rewards or you know, debt of that too. But once you get inside and you start looking, it's not like that. Different understanding. So to ask one question from the relative perspective and expect an absolute answer, or to mix them and match them, you know, in a kind of a ask a question that's got some relative and some absolute, you know, teacher, first thing the teacher's got to do is kind of separate out, well, this is over here and that's over there, so I'll answer this part and then I'll answer that part, and you figure out how to put them together.
Yeah.
like that. Lynn?
So I've heard teachers talk about sort of moments of awakening and, and talk to teachers about that. And, you know, given that, you know, by your description, I haven't started Vipassana yet.
I didn't make that evaluation.
But, you know, I kind of wonder if you could say something about just your thoughts on that, on this experience of moments where maybe the mind doesn't have delusion, aversion, clinging. You know, so it's not so linear, perhaps, or just like you. I don't know even how to ask a question except just.
A moment of awareness is a moment without delusion. It's a moment of wakefulness. And, you know, if you're just aware of breathing in when you breathe in and what it feels like, that's a moment of wakefulness. Now, is it particularly insightful and liberating? Not usually. But nevertheless, even at that level of momentum of awareness, sometimes we get these glimpses, for example, into the formation of our personality structure, and we just go, holy cripe, I get it. Now I really understand why I am the way I am. You know, you really do get these glimpses into your personality structure, and particularly when, you know, the blind side, you know, the dark side, the shadow side of our personality, when you get a glimpse into, wow, I've never seen this about myself. Shameful, humiliating, but you can't deny it. That's awakening to some part of yourself that's just, it's hard to get, but when you see it, it's awakening, it's liberating, it's freeing from what you didn't know before. Of course, that, and it's fair to say that's awakening, that's liberation, that's a moment of relief, letting go of some delusion that you've been living with for God knows how long. And so, yeah, it's a moment of awakening. Let's call it just what it is. It's a moment of liberation. It's a moment of seeing more clearly. It's a moment without delusion and without attachment, without aversion, without confusion. Great. And there's progressively more. Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like that that moment, that intermittent moments of selflessness can be extremely disorienting. At that moment, I often would think of the title of the book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, because it's great because it is such a lightness, a lightening, but it's also really unbearable because, for one thing, it's so transient, and the other thing is there isn't anything to grasp onto. So how do you transition through that sense of disorientation to what is ever next?
Sure. When experience or understanding conditions a feeling of disorientation, right? That's what you're saying, right? The feeling of disorientation then becomes that which is being known. If you try to undisorient yourself, or try to figure it out, or try to stabilize, you're struggling. But if you just acknowledge, oh, disoriented, feeling disoriented, you know, and all the fear that comes with that, or the anxiety that comes with that, just fear, disoriented, that's what's being known. That will get you through. It too is impermanent. Not very satisfying answer, is it?
it's a very simple answer.
Well, and that's it. You hit it right on the head. It's very simple. Everything that you come to know is just, no matter how dramatic, how wonderful, how terrifying, how gross, how humiliating, whatever, it's just And if you can manage that, you'll get there. But it's hard because we want to say, we want to say, that is me. I am disoriented. Or fear. I am fearful. No, it's just disoriented, feeling known, being known. Fear, being known, rather than, I'm so afraid. When the awareness gets identified with the object, there's self. When awareness is separate from the object, meaning things are being known, then you don't create a self to suffer. Otherwise, you suffer. It's okay, suffer. You know, eventually you'll let go. No. And above all, you know, the sixth controlling faculty of your spiritual practice is humor. Yeah. Well, humor, dukkha. Yeah.
Yeah, so you're talking about awareness and, of course, everything changing all the time, but then the part of your mind that's aware, I know it's not permanent, but... it's hard to put this into words, but what part of your mind is watching this and saying it's, you know, that, okay, that this is, whatever, you know, that this is shame or this is anger or, you know, this is a flower, or, you know, that there's, it seems like there's some part there that seems to have some permanent, I mean, that part that's aware, how do you,
well,
is it the watcher part?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty clear that there is observing happening, right? It's not so clear that there's an observer. There's observing is happening. And sometimes that observing has deep and accurate understanding, wisdom, right? If those occur with greater frequency, it will condition the appearance of a wise being doing this. But that's a delusion. That's an ascribing a significance and meaning and value to something that's not really happening. But we only see that when we're able to see the momentarily arising and impermanent nature of not only these things, but this also. If you think there's this that just notices this, wrong. But that's what it feels like. It feels like I'm observing this and this and this and this and this. And that's how it seems for a long time. You know, and we get familiar with this. At some point, we're going to realize it's not this, it's this. And that has its own challenge. You know, it's getting to be 4 o'clock. I've told you everything I know. So?
Huh?
Oscar's night?
Oscar's
night. Oscar who?